It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today we have the saga of how a young girl from India becomes a leading actress and a culinary authority. Our guest is Madhur Jaffrey, actress, producer, and director, and a pioneer in introducing authentic Indian food to the West. Her father wanted her to be a diplomat. Madhur had other ideas. Jane and Michael Stern have found great kolache in a LaGrange, Texas gas station. Tea expert Bill Waddington tells us all about scented teas. We go behind the scenes in a New York restaurant near Ground Zero to hear how a family of workers are doing. We've got tips for finding good cheap wine, and we talk cooking with a witch. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this. Welcome to Kitchen Chronicles, where knowledge is power and cooking is pleasure, a practical guide to nourishing ourselves and the people we care about. Let's talk about some of the things that you can do with autumn and winter squashes. These are the squashes with hard, inedible skins and usually with colorful yellow or orange flesh. They can range in taste from almost as sweet as a sweet potato to as delicate as a zucchini squash. Let's start with shopping for squash. Go to the places where the squash is the freshest, and if you can get organic squash, all the better. So, try farmers markets and stores that offer a good selection in locally grown produce. Look for squash that's unblemished, with no soft spots or shriveling. The tauter, the fresher the skin looks, the fresher the squash. Store winter squash unwrapped in a cool place, at about 50 degrees, or you can put it in the refrigerator. The great thing about this kind of squash is that you can keep it easily for several weeks. Once it's cut, wrap it in plastic wrap and keep it about 5 days. Okay, all that's fine, but with all the squash on the market, which kind tastes better? Well, the sweetest squashes are the butternut, the sugar pumpkin, the Japanese squash that's called kabocha, another one that's called delicata, and still another, it's small, it's called sweet dumpling. The delicate, more vegetable-tasting varieties include Hubbard, banana, acorn, and regular pumpkins. Now on to cooking with squash. Remember one truism with all vegetables. If you roast it, it will taste sweeter and richer. If you brown it in a sauté pan, it'll taste more like a grilled piece of meat. If you steam it or boil it, it'll taste purer and more delicate. Let's start with one of my favorite ways of serving squash that takes practically no work. Roasted sweet squash with balsamic vinegar. Take a sweet squash like butternut, the Japanese, or the sweet dumpling. Don't peel it. Just cut it into pieces that are 3 or 4 inches square. Scrape away any seeds. Preheat your oven to 400 degrees, rub the squash with olive oil, and then put the pieces on a piece of heavy-duty foil. Now, this foil is going to be essentially your baking pan. You don't have to worry about cleanup. Sprinkle them with salt and pepper, roast about an hour, or until you can easily pierce the squash with a knife. Serve it sprinkled with your favorite balsamic. If you serve this up with a green salad and some grilled fish, you've got a great dinner. Now I want to take this roasting idea a step further. Let's make ravioli filled with sweet squash and cheese. Now, this is a dish American chefs are discovering, but it's been popular in northern Italy, since somewhere around the 1500s, which proves there really isn't anything new under the sun. Roast the squash just the way I said. Let it cool, scrape it off the skin, and mix it with freshly grated Parmigiano-Reggiano cheese. Add some nutmeg and salt and pepper to taste. You could even throw minced onion in if you like. Fill fresh pasta squares, sealing the edges. Cook it in boiling salted water and serve it with a little butter and broth that you flavored with fresh sage leaves. It's a dynamite meatless supper. This is soup season, and I use squash instead of potatoes or flour or cream to make a creamy soup. Here's one way of turning this idea into a good soup. You cut up raw squash. Mix it into lots and lots of browned onions. Throw in a generous amount of minced garlic and the zest of a big lemon. Add water to cover and your favorite spices. I add fresh ginger, allspice, and I always throw in a little bit of hot chili powder. I like the kick. It plays against all those other flavors. Simmer it slow and easy until it's creamy. Then puree it with fresh-cut Granny Smith apples. Try a double batch. Stick some in the refrigerator, and a couple of nights later, you'll have a quick weeknight supper. For a fancy finish, top the soup with toasted whole mustard seeds that you cook with some browned arugula leaves. Very, very sexy finish. So, pick up some sweet winter squashes, try roasting them, making filled pasta with them, do a main dish soup, and join us again for the next edition of Kitchen Chronicles. Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, the place you can register for Target's own kitchen essentials. Hard anodized cookware from Calphalon. It's professional quality heavy cookware with tempered glass lids and ergonomic handles. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. Today we learn how two passions come together to make a life. Our guest is Madhur Jaffrey. She started out an actress. You've seen her in many films, including Merchant Ivory's Cotton Mary. Then there's the other Madhur Jaffrey, the woman who introduced America to authentic Indian food. Tea expert Bill Waddington explains how scented and flavored teas get that way. Reporter Annie Chaney takes us to a staff meal in a New York restaurant near Ground Zero. Philip Silverstone gives us some tips for checking out good cheap wines. And as we do every week, we'll be opening the lines for your calls in the second half of the show. That number is 800-537-5252. Well, Jane and Michael Stern are stepping into the studio. They write the road food column in Gourmet Magazine. So you two, what's the latest discovery?
Oh, we found a great place. We've been traveling in LaGrange, Texas, and we came to a screeching halt in our car when we saw a big sign over at Texaco station that says, "We gotcha kalacha," which is kind of a twisted version of, I call them kolaches, the Polish pastries, they're Czechoslovakian pastries that can range from being really bad and heavy and leaden to feathery and flaky and just wonderful. And the weirdest thing is at this Texaco station, Weichel's Store and Bakery in LaGrange, Texas, you get the best kolaches we have ever had.
Well, now what exactly are they like?
Well, imagine a Danish pastry, okay. Fruit-filled or poppy seed-filled or cheese-filled, but imagine one better than any you've ever had, with a very soft kind of potato dough and with the fillings kind of really extraordinarily good, not just jelly, but really kind of wonderful fruit preserves or the poppy seed is especially good. And throughout the part of Texas that is east of Austin, which also happens to be great barbecue country, kolaches are extremely popular because of all the people of Czech ancestry who settled there. So kolaches are very popular throughout this area, and most of them are served in bakeries. And, you know, generally speaking, convenience store gas stations are not where we look for really good food. This is a great exception to that rule.
So are they baking between pumping gas?
No. The bakery is a kind of separate area within the convenience store. The convenience store has all the conveniences that you would expect at a gas station. But then there's the bakery, which is so special that, in fact, people call ahead and order their kolaches lest they run out of the peach or prune or whatever your favorite flavor happens to be.
With the exception of a few really good hot pepperoni rolls in West Virginia and a smoked alligator sandwich that Michael and I found in Acadian, Louisiana, we've never eaten anything good in a gas station convenience store. I mean, usually it's just beef jerky and, you know, candy bars and...
Lynn, as you probably remember, I'm always looking for the great corn dog. the corn dog of my dreams. I almost found it, in fact, at Weichel's. And, you know, corn dogs are a specialty of gas station convenience stores. In fact, what they have at Weichel's is a pig in a blanket. But this is no ordinary pig and no ordinary blanket. It's, in fact, not a corn dog. What it is a wonderful homemade kielbasa sausage in a kind of crusty roll that you eat just like a regular pig in a blanket, but it's like the best one you ever ate.
Weichel's is, I mean, if you look at it from the outside, it looks like just the most dreary Texaco gas station you could ever find. And we were very dubious when we went inside about whether the kolaches could possibly be any good, but they were a 10 on a 1 to 10 scale.
Okay, so you've got the corn dog that isn't the corn dog, it's a pig in the blanket, and you've got the kolaches, and they're in a Texaco station in Texas.
In LaGrange, Texas.
Oh, okay. Hey, guys, thanks.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
Rumors spread around in that Texas town. Right to check outside the game. You know what I'm talking about. Just let me know if you're gonna go to that whole mile on the range. They got a lot of nice girls.
Because our engineer is a former hard rock singer, that was ZZ Top doing LaGrange. Well, the Stern's latest book is Blue Plate Specials and Blue Ribbon Chefs. Now, you can hear them every week here on The Splendid Table, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. Merchant Bill Waddington is back. Now, Bill spent the last couple of decades studying and selling tea, and in his spare time, he's giving us a tea primer. Bill, welcome.
It's great to be back again, Lynn.
Bill, I want to talk about scented teas, you know, like Earl Grey and jasmine. What are they? How does that happen?
Well, there's probably two different categories of tea that you're talking about. Truly scented teas and then what we call flavored teas. Scented teas are simply teas that have had another substance brought close to them in close proximity, and the tea leaves absorb the aroma of that other substance. The most common one is certainly jasmine.
Right.
But there are many, many other ones out there. Flavor teas are something that actually have another substance introduced into the tea itself, another ingredient put into the tea, mm-hmm. applied to the leaf. Sometimes it's sprayed on, sometimes it's a physical, like a piece of coconut or a piece of vanilla is blended in with the tea leaves, and you actually brew something with the tea leaves as opposed to just an aroma that's been added.
Okay, so for instance, what is Earl Grey?
Earl Grey is a flavor tea. What they do is take a black tea, typically, and they apply oil of bergamot. And bergamot's a citrus fruit native to the Mediterranean. Mm-hmm. I know they grow it on Sicily. And they take the rind and extract an essential oil from the rind, and that's literally usually sprayed over tea leaves. And then it's applied to the tea leaves itself. And it's a very, very fresh, citrusy aroma. When you get good, fresh, quality Earl Grey, you can smell and tell that it's citrusy in nature.
Has this been going on for a long time, or is it new?
Scenting and flavoring teas has been going on for thousands of years. There are written records of, in southeastern China, flavoring and scenting teas with orange blossoms, gardenia, magnolia, orchid, and occasionally some extreme examples of flavoring might include flavoring with ginger or garlic or even onion. So the idea of adding something to tea to add another flavor has been around for a long time.
And it's not always a gentle flavor.
It's not always a gentle flavor. Not always a gentle
Well,
flavor.
Well, I can't resist. You've got stuff steaming and steeping. What have you brought?
We brought a few examples to maybe taste and to sniff a little bit. Probably, as I said before, the most famous scented tea is jasmine tea. And I brought an example of a particular jasmine tea. It's actually a relatively new innovation in terms of jasmine teas. But a lot of people think it's probably the best jasmine tea that's commercially available.
This is like having a bouquet of jasmine flowers in your hand. It is pure, unadulterated flower. The name is great. Jasmine Dragon Phoenix Pearl. Okay, tell me about this. It's in little nuggets almost.
There's an expression in the tea business that all good tea comes from two leaves and above, the top two leaves of the plant and the bud of the unformed leaf. These pearls are actually the bud of the unformed tea leaf and the next leaf down, the youngest whole leaf, plucked together in a single unit, then scented with jasmine blossoms five or six times, then usually hand-rolled into these tight little balls, into these pearls. And the most amazing thing about them, the flavor and the aroma is intense. It's almost sensual. But they're meant to be brewed multiple times, and they get better as you steep these pearls because it takes about five or six infusions of water for the pearls to unfurl the entire way.
The color of this tea is the pale, pale straw gold color, and the aroma is like a bouquet of fresh jasmine. And it tastes, it's very gentle, but it has a flowery flavor to it. So what else have you got?
Another very traditional Chinese scented tea is black tea with rose petals. It's often called rose kangu, and it's a lovely black tea.
Oh,
and again,
yeah.
It's just adding the rose petals, and the tea leaves absorb the aroma and the essence of the rose itself. And as with
and it
jasmine,
smells like roses. What does it taste like?
It'll taste like sipping roses a little bit with a nice, gentle black tea in the background.
Oh, this is lovely. This is lovely.
What they can use to flavor and scent teas is literally just limited by your own imagination. Probably the most famous flavor tea is Earl Grey.
Yeah, this is that Earl Grey you talked about. Oh, yeah. This one I get a real citrusy aroma from. And are those long leaves in there actually from the citrus?
No. Again, all that's used in Earl Grey is the oil of bergamot. So it's an oil extracted from the rind. In this case, it's just a particularly long leaf tea. A good test of good quality Earl Grey is, if you can tell that it's a citrus thing, then you probably got a pretty good Earl Grey on your hands. Typically, supermarket Earl Greys, they've been sitting around so long, or they're flavored with artificial flavors that a lot of folks don't even realize Earl Grey is a citrus-based tea.
Uh-huh.
There's probably one other scented tea that's worth mentioning quickly, and that's Lapsang Souchong. A lot of folks may not even be aware that it is a scented tea. It's a pretty famous tea in its own right.
Yeah, I never realized that was scented. Okay.
See what you get from the aroma.
Smoky.
It's a tea
really smoky.
It's a tea that's been smoked over pine fires for a long time. Think a smoked ham.
Uh-huh.
And the aroma.
This is amber colored, and it is smoky, but you get a sweet background of tea. Mmm. Oh, that's wonderful for a winter night.
It was
smoky and tea together.
It was Winston Churchill's favorite drink with a little slug of brandy in there, but he would drink it every morning when he started his day off.
Even without the brandy, it's not bad. Yeah. Hey, Bill, thank you.
Sure.
Tea expert Bill Waddington owns the Tea Source in St. Paul, Minnesota. You can find the names of the teas Bill talked about on our website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, the dual life of Indian food authority Madhur Jaffrey, a New York restaurant, makes a comeback, and open lines for your calls. Reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Target, dedicated to helping you discover new and exciting ideas that help you enjoy everything there is about cooking for your friends and family, just like you do here at The Splendid Table each week. Online at Target.com. Thank you.
Mater Jaffrey is one of the world's leading authorities on the foods of India. Her new book is Madhur Jaffrey's Step-by-Step Cooking, covering much of Southeast Asia as well as India. But Madhur has another life in film. She's an actress, a producer, and a director. You've seen her in Merchant Ivory films as well as other productions. Her latest projects are the film Chutney Popcorn and a TV sitcom pilot called New York Spice. Madhur, you are a very busy woman. It's good to have you with us.
It's wonderful to meet you this way, too.
Well, Madhur, what was your childhood like? Where were you born?
I was born in my grandfather's house in Delhi, which was a huge, rambling house on the banks of the river Jamna in the capital city. And my grandfather had built this house himself and was built almost like a fort come mansion, a mixture of all these things. And I grew up in a joint family with a lot of other people, 40 other people at times, swelling to 100 or more at weddings. So I have this great sense of belonging because we are a Delhi family. We've been there for 1,000 years. So we belong to the city. And then there was this very loving, sometimes fractious family, but always together, always doing things together, going on summer holidays together, going on picnics together. So I think that made me grow up with a great sense of love and belonging.
Now, you did get to England eventually, didn't you?
Yes, I had wanted to be an actress. And at that stage in India, there were no drama schools. So I had applied to the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art for a scholarship, and I got it. And I went to England and studied there for 2 years.
You know, I should mention that from what I recall, very few people receive a scholarship to the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art.
It is hard to get into, and I did rather well there. Lots of people do it. Lots of people get in, but it's a very funny system. When I was there, they didn't keep you there unless you could pass an exam every 3 months. So each class, about a third of each class was fired every 3 months. It was awful because you lived in this perpetual fear that you wouldn't last to the next term. But somehow I managed to get through.
How did your family feel about you wanting to be an actress?
Well, you know, it was funny. My father always thought I should go into the Foreign Service and be an ambassador or something rather grand like that, or into the Civil Service and become a minister of some sort. And when I became an actress, he kept telling all his friends, "This is her hobby. This is her hobby." And he never quite took it seriously. And I remember when he was getting very old and president of India was giving some of us awards for a film that we had done. My father was there and his old friends were there. And he was still going around saying, "It's her hobby."
I want to keep talking about the acting, but first, when did food come into the picture?
Well, we always ate well. And my father and the whole family were very interested in food. But I had a family where not only my mother was very good at cooking, but my father was terribly interested. He never cooked. But if there was a family wedding, then what would happen was that caterers would come to your house and they would camp out for a week or so and they would cook breakfast, lunch, dinner. And that food was so marvelous. It had a very special taste. It tasted like nothing you made at home. And my father would supervise this kitchen, this outdoor kitchen, which was under tents. And I learned all that from him. And also, he grew everything. We had our own garden since I was very little.
Now, when did you first do serious writing about food?
Well, that was a whole other thing. I had done my Royal Academy of Dramatic Art. I had come to America. See, my great hero was Marlon Brando. And I wanted to be Marlon Brando. I just thought he was the greatest actor on earth and that I should come to America because this is where Marlon Brando originated. And his style of acting was the method, was what I thought I wanted to do. So that's why I came to America. And then I never got any acting work. It was very difficult. I started off Broadway at $10 a week. And in my contract, I had signed then to clean and cook for the director and iron his shirts as well. That was all in the contract. So this is what I was doing. And I wasn't getting any acting work. And I had little kids. I was married, and I had three little daughters, and they had to go to school. So I started writing, and I was writing about just about anything I could think of, what I was good at. And I was good at the arts. That's all I knew. So I was writing about music. I was writing about theater. I was writing about sculpture, painting, all these things. And food. Because I had started cooking. I didn't cook in India, but I was forced to teach myself how to cook. And my mother sent me these wonderful air letters, which I've preserved, with recipes. And obviously, I had a palate. I had a taste memory. And I could recreate things from my mother's rather skimpy notes, a little bit of this and a little bit of that. But I remember the taste of these foods, and I was able to recreate them. So I'd started cooking. So I started writing these pieces on food, and they took off. They had a life of their own.
When was this now?
We are talking about the late 60s. And my first cookbook, I was asked to do my first cookbook in the late 60s, and the editor said, how long will it take you? I said, well, 3 months. How long does it take? Just put it all together, all the things I've been cooking. But then I realized this other side of me, which is the perfectionist side, and I was testing and retesting, and it took me 5 years to do the first book, and it came out in 73.
Well,
and since then, there have been umpteen.
Yes, there have, and there have been television series, and there's also been at least 16 films. But right now, you're doing something that is quite unusual if you think about the food angle. You're doing a TV sitcom. Can you tell us about that?
Well, we're trying to get it off the ground. We're trying to raise really money for it and get it all right so it can be done. And it's set in a 7-Eleven kind of store, where the family who runs it is an Indian family. But it's not just got Indians in it. It's got, you know, people who come and work there. One person is black, one person is Korean, one person is Chinese, there's a Jewish guy. So there are all kinds of people who are the main characters in this particular sitcom, and it's high comedy, and I love comedy. I mean, the last few films I've done have been like Cotton and Mary, have been so heavy and in a way depressing. This woman almost goes mad. I'm just dying to do very light comedy.
What's the name of the series?
The New York Spice. New York Spice.
Madhur Jaffrey, thank you.
Thank you.
Madhur Jaffrey's latest book is Madhur Jaffrey's Step-by-Step Cooking. She left us with a recipe. It's called Lamb in Dark Almond Sauce. And you can find it on our website, splendidtable.org.
It's the perfect time of year. Somewhere far away from here. I feel fine enough, I guess, considering everything's a mess. There's a restaurant down the street where hungry people like to eat. I could walk, but I'll just drive. It's colder than it looks outside.
Needless to say, the events of September 11th have left their mark on all of us. We've heard so much about the struggles of businesses in the area around Ground Zero. It was a vibrant neighborhood full of shops, families, schools, and of course restaurants. One of New York's most beloved is the tiny four-star Chanterelle. Reporter Annie Cheney went to see how the people at Chanterelle are doing.
There's still an eerie calm in Lower Manhattan. Every time a plane thunders overhead, the few people on the streets here peer up anxiously at the sky. Many of the local residents are just settling back into their homes. But still, nothing's returned to the way it was before September 11th, and New Yorkers are looking for comfort anywhere they can find it. For the staff at the famed four-star restaurant Chanterelle, located just 6 blocks from Ground Zero, coming back to work has provided the greatest solace of all.
Well, we were closed for a week and a half, and certainly in my case, I couldn't wait to get back. Just the ambiance here, we just needed the movement, needed the contact with the customers. needed to have David's cooking. There's a certain comfort in being here at Chanterelle.
Master sommelier Roger Dagorn has been part of the Chanterelle family of staff for the past 8 years. That may sound like a long time in the restaurant world, but at Chanterelle, it's not unusual for employees to stay on for years. Andrea Barnes has been a waiter at Chanterelle for close to a decade. Since the tragedy, she's waited anxiously for news about the regular customers who worked in and around the World Trade Center.
It's heavy, and it's sad, and it's also beautiful at the same time, you know, being here. When you do see a regular customer come in, you get really happy. You're like, you just feel very happy.
It's helped, too, to be reunited with the rest of the Chanterelle staff. In particular, Barnes says she's taken comfort in their daily ritual dinner together. Staff meals have been a tradition at the restaurant since it opened in 1979. Every day, chef and owner David Waltuck prepares something special for his employees. Unlike the elegant and complex food that Chanterelle is famous for, the staff meals are homey, hearty fare, just the kind of dishes that give you the courage to get up and go on. In the kitchen, Waltuck is putting the finishing touches on today's meal.
We made chicken breast stuffed with curried couscous, and we made curried chickpeas, so zucchini and tomato sauce, something simple.
If you've ever worked in a restaurant, you know that most staff dinners are notorious for being inedible. Often they don't even exist. But here in the elegant peach and dark wood dining room, beneath two gleaming brass chandeliers, plates of fragrant chicken and steaming couscous, bottles of wine and water are laid at a long table covered in a linen cloth. Waltuck, his wife, and their 12-year-old daughter Sarah are seated with the rest of the staff. Adrian Mercia has worked for Waltuck as a waiter for the past 2 years.
We never call him chef. I mean, I've worked in a lot of restaurants in this town and in other towns, and most of them kind of adhere to the, you know, the French standard where it's like, you know, good morning, chef, hi, chef.
Waltuck goes by Pops instead. Although he's quiet and shy on the surface, I quickly learn that beneath his reserved demeanor is someone else entirely. It's the kind of thing that you'd only find out by visiting someone's family and sitting down together at the dinner table. Little by little, with copious good food and wine, come the anecdotes about Waltuck. And in the congenial dining room, it's almost possible to forget the scene outside on the street.
He's a bit of a prankster. I don't know what stories you've heard about him, but he'll do things, I mean, really crazy things, like take the head of a wolf fish and stick it in the toilet. So then you go downstairs and, you know, have to do your business. There'll be a big fish head sticking out of it. So this is very much his style. He's very unlike most chefs in this town, I think.
In fact, when he was asked to write a Chanterelle cookbook several years ago, Waltuck decided he didn't want to add to the volumes of what he calls food porn, those heavy coffee table books full of glossy photographs.
I wanted to do something that was more lighthearted and just less of a heavy-duty, serious, important cookbook, and try to do something that was just really useful and fun.
And so, he wrote about the dishes he lovingly prepares for his employees. The book, published last year, is appropriately entitled Staff Meals. It was co-authored by Chanterelle alum Melissa Phillips, and it's full of unfussy but wonderfully flavorful and satisfying recipes. Despite the somber mood in Lower Manhattan and around the country, Roger Dagorn suggests you buy the book and follow the example set by the staff at Chanterelle.
Eat good food, drink good wine, enjoy life.
I have to agree with him. For The Splendid Table, I'm Annie Cheney in New York.
Chanterelle chef David Waltuck's cookbook is Staff Meals, and you can get his recipe for those chicken breasts stuffed with curried couscous on the proverbial website, splendidtable.org. I don't know about you, but for me, this is not the time I want to know about yet another wine that's going to cost me a fortune. Which brings me to our next guest. Philip Silverstone has dedicated his professional life to unearthing good wine that costs less than $10 a bottle. He talks about the wines on his website, thesilverstonecollection.com. And he's joined me here in the studio. Philip, welcome.
Lovely to be here.
Phil, you've built a career on saying that cheap wines, $10 a bottle and under, are really good buys and good drinking. Give us some guidelines.
Well, guidelines in wine is always difficult, and I'm so aware of people's intimidation with wine. So as far as guidelines go, the most important thing is to be comfortable in going into a wine store and saying, look, I only want to spend a maximum of $10. Help me out. You find the person in the store who is the most knowledgeable. I don't mean a snob. I just mean somebody that seems to have a passion and an interest in wine. And say to them, look, I'm going to be coming in here on a regular basis. I want you to be my best mate. If you take care of me and take me on a lovely wine adventure within my budget, I'll come back regularly and we'll chat about what I discovered and what you discovered and we'll have fun with this.
Well, are there certain countries where there are going to be good buys?
Oh, I mean, really and truly, I like to say that the entire planet contains gems. I mean, even the countries which I consider to be overhyped, and with all due respect, I think, you know, France has over the years been put on such a high pedestal, and the over expensive wines from France are the ones that people tend to fawn over. But by the same token, if you go to the region of the store that features French wines, look for the southern French wines, Languedoc, Roussillon, Provence, Rhone, and there are such extraordinary wines for, you'll get change out of $10. The other extraordinary place, I mean, it's just one vast affordable vineyard, is Chile. I mean, it's just, I can imagine these big sort of neon signs saying shop here. But it's so true because Chile hasn't become overhyped. And overhyped to me means let's put the price up next year because people will pay more. So Chile will definitely get you in under $10. You know, I'd also look for places in the United States that are not. We're falling into the same syndrome here. When you talk to people about wines from the United States, what's the first thing they say?
California. Right.
And there are places to the north of California. In the state that I live in, Pennsylvania, people may laugh, and they do. But I found gems in Pennsylvania. I found gems in New Jersey, in New Mexico, in Texas. Just go around the wine store and look at the wines that don't look like they're overhyped and expensive, and experiment with them.
Are there bargains in certain vintages, in certain years?
Not in the wines that I recommend. If you're spending $10 and under, don't worry about the vintage. The only thing that the vintage helps is it's sort of a sell-by date on a carton of milk, for example. If it says it's 2 years old, the vintage is the time that it was harvested. So let's suppose we're in 2001 and you see a bottle of $10 and under and it says 1865. You don't want to touch it. But if it says 1998, 1999, that's fantastic.
Okay. Is there one rule of thumb that you like to apply when you're looking at a bottle of wine?
Well, you know, if you don't know too much about wine, and I don't profess to know as much as I should, one rule of thumb is look for the name of a dependable importer. And again, the person in the store can help you. But one tip here, sample some fabulous German wines, which people tend to overlook. And when it comes to German wines, I'm not going to be specific. Look for the name of the country's leading importer out of Washington. His name is Terry Thies, T-H-E-I-S-E. Anything with his name as the importer is going to be stunning and highly slurpable.
Uh-huh. Okay. Phil, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Phil Silverstone is the creator of thesilverstonecollection.com. You can find the advice he offered on our website, splendidtable.org. Okay, it's time for our weekly food challenge. Now, here's the food question. Who created the microwave oven? We're going to have that answer in a moment, and we'll be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. We will be taking your calls this hour, so give us a ring. That number is 800-537-5252. But before going to the phones, I've got the answer to this week's trivia question. The question was, who created the microwave oven? It was Percy LeBaron Spencer, and it was an accident. The tube that produces microwave radio signals was invented during World War II, but the last thing it was intended for at that time was cooking. Now, after the war, Spencer, who was a scientist at the Raytheon Company, was working with the microwaves when the candy bar in his pocket melted. This tipped him off to the fact that microwave heating could raise the internal temperature of foods much faster than a conventional oven. Well, Raytheon was fast on its feet. By 1947, the company produced the first commercial microwave oven. They called it the Radar Range. But it was not what you would call a big seller. It cost about $30,000 in today's money, it weighed 750 pounds, and it stood over 5 feet tall. Definitely not a countertop model. But by the late 1960s, the industry had gotten its act together. Microwave ovens hit big time. Today, 90% of us own a microwave, and they still cook meat to that appetizing color of gray. But they bake a potato in 7 minutes, make great popcorn, and can reheat a cup of coffee better than anything else on the market.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me. Maybe it's
the lines are officially open for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. Okay, let's see who's up. We have Jennifer on the line. So, Jennifer, what do you want to talk about?
Peppers. I have a plethora of peppers in my garden and want to make use of them. And I was wondering about red pepper jams and jellies.
Ooh, this sounds great. Well, you could make jelly. And I must confess, I have never done this, but I have actually stood in quite a few kitchens where it was being done.
Okay.
Yeah, and essentially, when you do a chili or, you know, a pepper jelly, what you need is pectin, which you can get in the supermarket. And usually people use apple juice and sugar and the pectin, which sort of gels everything, and a little bit of lemon juice because you want some contrast to the heat of the pepper and the sweetness
right.
of the sugar. And then you chop up the chilies.
So it would be safe to go ahead with these red hot chili peppers.
Yeah. Now, the sugar and a little bit of acidity and vinegar or lemon juice is going to cut a little bit of the heat, but it's still going to be very hot.
Right. Okay. Now, I also had a question. Do you have any source for sugar-free jelly making?
No, I really don't. I'd say go to Amazon.com or Jessica's Biscuit. or Cole Kitchen Arts and Letters in New York City. These are all food book sources.
Okay.
Yeah.
And do you know anything about stringing up the chili peppers? A couple friends had mentioned that.
What you need for that is plenty of air and a lot of air circulation and not a damp place, someplace that's rather dry. So when you string them up, you try to distance them a bit. So you might loop and tie around their stem, give a little length of cord, and then loop and tie. You know what I'm saying? You don't cluster them, because if they're all, you know, really tightly clustered.
And just regular thread?
Yeah, cotton string.
Okay.
Sure. And what you want to do is make sure they're not all crowded together, because they can tend to mold.
Okay.
But sure, you just need, where do you live?
On Martha's Vineyard.
It tends to be a little, what a nirvana, my, but you do tend to have that problem with the sea air.
Yeah.
If you've got, you know, if you have a place in your cellar near the heat source.
Right.
That might help it.
Okay.
I'm just thinking of the moisture in the air.
Right.
Yeah, but that's generally the whole idea, is you try to keep them a little separated.
And then once they're dried, are they decorative, or can you actually use them?
Oh, of course you can use them.
Okay,
oh.
That's what I thought.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but I know what you mean, because sometimes you say to yourself, gee, they look too good, and are they really safe?
And then does the heat intensify as they dry?
Yeah,
or?
Yeah, but
okay.
So does everything else.
Okay.
So all the flavors become more intense. Some are lost because the moisture in the pepper carries a certain level of flavor. But drying generally intensifies.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I will check those resources that you mentioned and
okay.
Go ahead.
Go for it. You know, there's one other thing you can do with that plethora of peppers. You can roast them. Light up your grill or your fireplace, someplace where you have a wood fire or a wood charcoal fire. And you can do what they do in New Mexico, which is you actually sear the peppers.
Okay.
So the skin blisters, stick them in paper bags, peel them, and then freeze them.
Oh, great idea.
And they taste like nothing on earth. And if you want to get rid of some of the heat, you get rid of the seeds as you defrost them.
Right. Okay.
But think about that, too.
Thank you very much.
Hey, great question. Take care.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Okay, if you want to get to us, you can get to us. You can call us at 800-537-5252. Let's see, who's up next? We've got Karen on the line. So, Karen, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I have an Italian heirloom squash that I'm growing.
Uh-huh.
And I was reading about zucchini in a book by Barbara Santich, it's a cookbook, called The Original Mediterranean Cuisine, which is kind of a medieval and Renaissance cookbook. All the recipes that she redacted are pre-New World. And she said that they didn't really have zucchini or squash, but they had a kind of edible gourd. I'm thinking this might be that edible gourd. It looks different from zucchini, and it tastes a little bit different. It tastes better, to my way of thinking. It's got kind of a hint of artichoke to it, and it's quite firm.
That sounds good. Is it? Does it have a hard skin, a very dense
no,
skin?
No, actually, it's what I think is that if I let it grow, and I do want to save seeds from this, that it would turn into like a larger hard skin gourd. But the skin is very soft, and I don't think it's something that we'll be able to see in the supermarket because it doesn't keep very well.
Mm-hmm. Does it look like zucchini?
It's actually looks a little rude. It's a long, they get about 18 inches to 24 inches long. And
that's a big
one name
squash.
Is called Zucchetta Rampicante, and the other is called Tromboncino, because they look a little like trumpets, I guess, because they flare out at the ends.
Hey, they sound beautiful.
Oh, they are. They're really neat.
And you're saying it tastes a little bit like artichokes.
They do. If you just stir fry them. And the thing is that unlike a zucchini, which has a large seed cavity, these are like all neck, and the only seed cavity is in the sort of bulb-like base at the bottom.
Yeah.
So, you know, you get this very firm, very tender. They slice up into these perfect round little chartreuse coins, and they stir-fry great, they sauté great. They're really good.
They sound great. And it's say it again, the name?
The name on the seed packet was Zucchetta Rampicante.
Okay.
Which I'm looking out my window at this monstrous plant right now, and you know, apparently that means climbing zucchini, but I think it just means zucchini everywhere.
Yeah, and the term zucchini comes from the word zucca, which generally means squash or pumpkin. It's a generic term. But now, did you have a question about these?
Yeah, I read in the Barbara Santich book that the Italians used to dry squash. Would you have suggestions on how to go about that? How to, you know, how much moisture do I need to get out of it? I was thinking of just cutting it up and putting it on a pan in a gas oven, but I guess I want some more.
That's going to probably work. And remember now, in Italy, and I'm not sure how far back they go, but I've seen illustrations for all kinds of squashes going back at least to the 1400s.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. And so there were many different kinds of squashes slash maybe gourds as well that were being grown. And I think in general, when you have something like this, which sounds like it's very dense and fleshy, slice it perhaps an inch thick. Put it or even less if you want, but I would put it on a rack over a pan and put it into a low oven, you know, somewhere around 150, 200 degrees. I've never done this, but it makes sense that it would work. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if you're going to dry it to the degree where it's sort of like leather, but you will dehydrate it a bit, and in doing that, you'll intensify any sweetness in the squash. The other thing you can do just for your own pleasure to eat immediately is rub it, cut it up into those pieces you talked about, rub it with olive oil, sprinkle it with coarse salt and pepper, and roast it.
Roast it
at about 400 degrees until it's tender and it'll be a little brown on the outside. It'll be delicious.
Would I cover it or just
No. Just put it on I cover a cookie sheet with foil when I do this kind of thing. I rub the foil with olive oil. I rub whatever I'm roasting with the olive oil.
Oh, man. Do you think I could do that on the grill, too?
Yeah, but do a slow cook on the grill.
Right.
Real slow, because it's, you know, this is going to take time to cook. It's going to take 40 minutes or so.
You just cut it into slices or chunks.
Yeah, yeah. And let it, and see what you get, because it should be delicious. And then, I mean, also, I think this would freeze really well.
Well, okay.
But the reality is there's a lot of diverse kinds of squash out there in Italy, some very
winter. Why don't we see more of the edible gourds?
I think because people don't know what to do with them. They don't buy them. Yeah, but hey, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, enjoy. Take care.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye, Karen. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. Now, we've got Samantha calling. Samantha, what's up?
Hey, Lynn.
Hey.
I have a question about yogurt marinades. I always think I want to do one, and then I can never find a recipe for one when I have a piece of chicken or lamb or something to do it with.
Right.
And I always punt with that. Is there a rule about how much flavoring you should put into a yogurt marinade to make it stay with the meat?
Now, are you familiar with the famous yogurt marinade that is your marinade that's used in India, and it's for tandoori chicken?
Right, that's right. That's what I think of when I think of a yogurt marinade.
Yeah, because it has a ton of spices.
Right.
The basic thing with marinades is this. You always over-season them because, and with yogurt, you have a lot of lactic acid and culture working, and a couple of things. If the meat's very tender, you don't want to leave it in a buttermilk or a yogurt marinade for more than, a couple of hours.
Like, what about chicken, though? How long would you do chicken?
Well, chicken, if you've got the skin on it especially, okay, I would say you could leave it overnight the way they do in India, but know that the white meat is going to be like a little chewy on the outside because what you've got is acids working away just on the surface of the meat.
But and doesn't it seem that yogurt marinade tenderizes meat more than other marinades?
It all depends how long it's, because it has a lot of acidic qualities to it.
Okay.
And after a long period of time, it can actually start to toughen. But the key with any marinade is you want it to be very heavily seasoned because only the surface of the meat, and maybe, you know, an eighth of or a sixteenth of an inch, gets permeated.
Okay.
And you want a lot of flavor in there.
So what would you put in a yogurt marinade for chicken?
Okay, other than the traditional Indian seasonings,
yeah.
I would do a ton of garlic. I would do a puree of onion. I would throw literally 2 or 3 tablespoons of something like a sweet paprika.
Okay.
And I would use, I think I'd even stop there. That would be a dynamite combination.
Okay.
Got the idea?
I got the idea. Thank you.
Okay, hey,
all right.
Great question. Bye. It's not often we find a reason to call a witch, but it's that time of year. Now, Trish Telesco is the author of A Kitchen Witch's Cookbook. She's active in the Universal Federation of Pagans, the Wiccan Pagan Press Alliance, and several historical guilds. and she prefers to be called a folk magician. Trish, welcome.
Thanks.
Trish, Halloween is always associated with witchcraft. But what's the significance within the practice of witchcraft?
Well, originally, depending on where you are in the world, round about this time of year is when all the festivals for the dead begin. It's not just in this part of the world or throughout the Celtic traditions. All over the world, as the sun started to move into the fall months, they associated fall and winter with death in the underworld because it was darker outside. Mm-hmm. It was a normal association. Among the Celts in particular, it became the new year. And any time that you're dealing with an in-between phase, between one year and the next, between dusk and dawn, between midnight and 1 a.m., this is the time that they thought that spirits could enter the world more easily, that the veil between the worlds grew thin, which is why the ancestors would come to visit. So they would leave out little treats that they thought that the fairies and their ancestors would enjoy. They'd make them special foods, and of course they do all kinds of things to protect themselves.
Yeah, with all those spirits around, you don't want to take any chances.
Really? It gives all new meaning to the things that go bump in the night.
Okay, so but how does this relate to what are the foods you're doing for Halloween?
Well, usually we do a pretty traditional harvest fare here. You know, my family likes apple and pumpkin pie, and both apples and pumpkins are traditional in magical circles because they've been used for a lot of different magical things. Like the old custom of bobbing for apples at this time of year, the person who got the biggest apple was supposed to also be insured of health for the coming year.
Ah.
So, you know, it ties into the apple a day concept, and you put them in your pie, and you know, that's for health. The pumpkin pie is to encourage protection again. Now, actually, the original jack-o'-lanterns were not pumpkins. They were turnips. So
turnips?
If you wanted to, I guess you could make a turnip pie, but I don't think that tastes anywhere near as good.
So are there any spells that you work in your kitchen?
Honest with you, I tend to avoid working any type of magic on Halloween only because the energy is so weird. You've got so many people doing funky things on that day and a lot of people who don't know anything really about magic that it tends to kind of leave everything helter-skelter.
Uh-huh.
I would rather either do it before or after and not deal with the energy during.
Trish, thank you.
Oh, no problem.
Trish Telesco is author of A Kitchen Witch's Cookbook, and you can find her recipe for rose geranium punch on our website, splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week, everybody. Thanks for being with us. And remember, call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. Until next week, let me leave you with a Japanese proverb. Better cover the fish than chase the cat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, offering the latest cooking tools and gadgets, from colanders to ladles to timers and garlic crushers. Target has the selection of cooking tools to fully outfit your kitchen. To get information on any of the guests you heard here today, simply mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to The Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. That's The Splendid Table, care of NPR, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. Or take a look at our website. That address is splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is produced by Sally Swift. Our associate producers are Jennifer Lubke and Jennifer Russell. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Be sure to join us next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
PRI, Public Radio International.